This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of January 1st, 2010. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Happy New Year, everyone, and may 2010 be all the things last year wasn't. Let's resolve to find jobs for every worker who wants one. And how about giving homeowners in foreclosure a second chance? Maybe credit card companies could borrow a heart from the Tin Man at 30% interest. And how about this? How about all of us finding a way to give just a little more? More than half of all charities experienced a dip in donations over the last year. But there is at least one philanthropic group that's maintaining its ranks. It's called the 50% League, a club made up of people who believe it is their moral obligation to give away as much of their money as they can. Lisa Napoli looks at what inspires these folks to engage in extreme giving.
Every weekend at her apartment in Oakland, California, Pilar Gonzalez makes 50 sandwiches and loads up the car with bottled water. Then she hits the streets in search of people to give them to.
Today I've put stickers on it that says, Con amistad, suerte y fe. And that's with friendship, luck, and faith.
Gonzalez hands out the sandwiches to day laborers who stand on the streets waiting for work.
So my sandwich might be the only thing they eat that day.
Sometimes she slips $5 bills to strangers or picks up the tab for people she sees at stores who need it. Helping people is in her DNA. She estimates that she gives away at least a quarter of what she earns every year, which last year was about $35,000. Gonzalez is a community activist by profession. She's widowed with a grown son, and she doesn't understand why some people think it's strange that a woman with a modest income chooses to give so much away.
They always say, let rich people take care of it. My making less doesn't get me off the hook, you know, of my responsibility to my fellow human beings.
Gonzalez's philosophy of giving is shared by Christopher Ellinger in Boston. Even though his circumstances are vastly different, 30 years ago, at the age of 23, Ellinger inherited $250,000.
I had enough to put money down on a house and to start work that I loved, and the rest I just wanted to give away because other people were in so much need.
That belief led him to dedicate his life to philanthropy, which included the creation of a club called the 50% League. It's a roster of people who've pledged to give away significant portions of their earnings. Some give more than half of their net worth.
We're not saying that you should be giving away any particular amount of money. 50% was just a totally arbitrary figure. We're saying that it's important to figure out what is enough for ourselves and how much can we give away in our lifetime and make a difference?
There are 125 members of the 50% League. They include people from all walks of life, from a television actor to a community college professor. Then there's Bob Graham, who lives in San Francisco. He made millions of dollars in the farming and food processing businesses. His life was changed by a man he'd never met.
I was reading the Wall Street Journal in my office one morning in 1983, and I read this account of a Chicago businessman who had been quite successful and then very unpredictably took up the cause of helping poor people.
Graham was so inspired by his story that he made a decision. He'd give away half of his money by the time he was 50.
Rather than accumulating more and more and more, for what end, I couldn't see. I decided to unzip my purse and share it.
Now, 20 years later, he's given away millions of dollars. His children were skeptical when he first shared the idea, but Graham and his wife involved the kids in the creation of a family foundation, and now they practice their philanthropy together. They all say it's the best thing they've ever done.
It was a great investment in the lives of other people, but it was also a great investment in my own life.
Graham says even people who aren't well off can find a way to give. Pilar Gonzalez in Oakland is an example of that. As she drives around looking for recipients of her generosity, she says she shares her story in the hopes of inspiring others.
I'm not a Buffett and I'm not a Gates, but I feel wealthy in my own life.
Get an agua, un sandwich?
Water bottle, yeah, I'll take a water bottle.
It took several hours of cruising around to distribute the food Gonzalez had packed in her old Toyota Camry, but she says it's the least she can do. She'll be back out here again next weekend. From Oakland, California, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
Maybe you're not in a position to give away half your income, but you still plan on scaling back, plugging the holes in your spending so you can save more every year. Well, one good place to start is by making little changes to the things you spend money on every day. And there's an article in this month's issue of Real Simple magazine that wants to help you do just that. It claims some families can save up to $5,000 a year. Kristen Van Ogtrop is the managing editor. And Kristen, tell us how you arrived at that amount.
We looked at this Bureau of Labor Statistics figure that said that the average American household spends more than $50,000 a year. And it's really concentrated for the most part across these six categories: food, healthcare, entertainment, home, transportation, and apparel. And so then we looked at all those six categories and found ways where you can save.
All right. Well, let's go through a few of these.
Okay.
By the way, I love the piggy bank on the cover of the magazine.
Oh,
it's so
thank you.
Cute.
I love that piggy bank, too. You know why? Because he makes you happy, that piggy bank.
He does.
He makes you think you can do it.
He makes you want to put money in him. That's for sure.
Right, exactly.
So we won't do all of these, but folks can buy the magazine for all the details. Let's start right where you start, which is with food.
Right, and, which is a big one, obviously.
Yeah, this is an expense that always surprises me how much it adds up when I go to the grocery store. And you mentioned that the average household spends almost $4,000 a year on groceries. What are a couple of the best ways to cut down on that grocery bill?
Well, I would say the easiest way is to start with a list, which sounds so obvious, but there is research that shows that people who avoid impulse shopping spend 23% less on their grocery bills, which can, you know, which can reap a savings of close to $1,000, again, depending on the size of your family and where you're shopping.
Right.
That's a no-brainer, and it's almost like a psychological ploy more than anything, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk briefly about all those home expenses. You have that as a category here as well. Property taxes to phone calls. What are a couple of the best tips you have there?
Well, a great tip for the times we're living in now is to take a hard look at your tax bill and think about appealing it. Recent market declines in housing prices means that for a number of people, they might be paying too much in property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So what you should do, it's a fairly easy process. Just get a copy of your house's assessment from your local assessor's office and compare it with assessments on similar houses in your town or in your area.
Hmm.
And about 75% of appeals actually do result in a reduction of taxes. For a person, you know, regardless of whether you own or rent, if you take a, like you're doing with your tax bill, if you take a hard look at your bills, according to the Citizens Utility Board, the average cell phone user could save over $300 a year just by shopping around for a better plan. Two great sites to go to are billshrink.com and lowermybills.com.
All right. Well, as I said, folks can get all these tips from the magazine. You know, Kristen, frugality was really sexy in 2009. But I wonder, you know, if things get better this year, do you think that's going to linger or is it going to become kind of old news?
You know, I think it's really going to linger. I think if you look at, you know, the economic necessities for a lot of people have certainly driven a change in behavior. I think for many people, even people who didn't lose their jobs, it's been kind of an interesting and valuable sort of reset moment. You know, where they look at their spending and they look at the way they live, and they've been given this kind of cultural permission to cut back, and it's been sort of liberating in a way. So regardless of how and when our economy recovers, I definitely think that people are going to have used this to reevaluate the way they're spending.
Kristen Van Ogtrop is the managing editor of Real Simple, and we've been talking about an article in the January issue that gives all kinds of money-saving suggestions that could add up to $5,000 worth of savings this year, 2010. Kristen, thank you so much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for having me.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Cutting expenses is one way to improve your finances. An even better way? Boost your take-home pay. Get a better job. Of course, in these days of 10% unemployment, competition for jobs is extreme. So you need to consider everything a potential employer may think about you, especially when you give them your email address. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
A few months ago, I started getting emails from friends and colleagues saying they were switching their email from Yahoo or Hotmail to Gmail. That's Google. I have a Yahoo address. Do they know something I don't? Is my email sending its own message about me? Duke University marketing professor Ken Wilber says yes.
It's like your haircut or the designer of the shirt that you're wearing. It's something that people notice, and it's part of the package.
I needed to know more, so I turned to Delassie Michalis. He's Marketplace's web developer, and he thinks about these kinds of things.
As soon as somebody says that they're, you know, so-and-so at earthlink.net or hotmail.com, it's an oh my God moment. Do you know what the internet is? Yahoo is like, okay. And then if you're Gmail, you're like, I can take you seriously.
What about AOL?
You said AOL. Wow. Is it still around? I mean, I can't believe it's still around.
Had my AOL email account for a little over 15 years.
Bert Flickinger is the managing director of the Strategic Resource Group. He tells retailers how to market things to young shoppers. What do clients say when he gives them his email?
When I give them an AOL email address, they say, I can't believe you're still on AOL. And I say, well, it's simple. I have one of the original addresses with no numbers, so it's easier for you to type.
There are 50 million Flickingers out there. Hotmail has 200 million users, Yahoo 260 million. Gmail is gaining on them, but 500 million people can't be uncool. Still, it's not about numbers, says Duke University's Ken Wilber. He says an email address is part of your brand, and if you're looking for a job or networking, the wrong address can make you look out of touch.
I really like to think about it as sort of the cardstock that you print your business cards on. You know, if you are out there looking for a job, then it certainly is something you want to think about in terms of what kind of image you're projecting.
So if you think your email address needs to send a new message, might be time to tell the old one
goodbye.
In Los Angeles at gmail.com, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Webster's defines charity as benevolent goodwill toward or love of humanity. And that's what you'd like to think you're expressing through a charitable donation until this happens to you.
I began sponsoring a little boy in India. I wrote him letters, he wrote me back. Then the charity abruptly informed me they'd expelled the child and his family from the program.
Coming up, the fine print of giving on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The big charitable giving season is now over. It tends to end December 31st as folks wrap up their year-end tax planning. But most charities would much rather hear from you throughout the year. In fact, more and more of them are finding you with your wallet out and open at the checkout line, supermarkets, pet stores, hotels. And, you know, a dollar here, a dollar there can definitely add up. But as Michael May tells us, there are some hidden costs.
Okay. Would you like to make a donation to KI Food Drive today? Is there a $1, $5 donation, or you can pick a bag over here we can gladly scan for you?
That's David Fiekek, a cashier and store director at the Randall Supermarket in Austin, Texas. He does more than ring up groceries. He's a fundraiser. Randall's Supermarket is owned by Safeway, which does four national charity drives each year in its more than 1,500 stores. The regional chains, like Randall's, can elect to do other drives as well, like this one benefiting the food bank. Connie Yates is director of public affairs for Randall's.
It's very important to give back to the community. It's very important to be involved in charities that matter to our customers.
The drive raises $15,000 and about 10,000 pounds of food. Carrie Cunnell is with the Capital Area Food Bank. She says Randall's was the first supermarket to do a checkout charity drive in Austin.
Since then, there have been other programs that have blossomed in our community and in across the country to replicate that. So it is becoming a more popular and more convenient way for grocery shoppers to be able to donate to their local food bank.
And all sorts of other charities. That can put pressure on workers who have to do the asking. Ron Lind is the president of UFCW Local 5, a union that represents supermarket employees. He told me that workers have complained about being pressured to solicit. And when I asked some Randall's shoppers what they thought of the checkout charity drive, they were divided. Emily Hampton gives at the register, but doesn't like being confronted every time she shops.
Yeah, it does really put you on the spot. And when you say no, the people around you in the back of the line, you're thinking, well, they don't know how often I'm here. We shop at Randall's quite a bit.
Last year, Safeway raised more than $50 million for causes like breast cancer and the Special Olympics. Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She says checkout charity programs have become popular during the recession.
Certainly any effort to tie charitable giving to shopping is a growing trend, in part because retailers want to find a way to persuade people to buy.
Palmer says checkout fundraising gives charities access to millions of potential givers, but she says there are drawbacks.
When you make a donation in response to a direct mail appeal or a telephone thing, they can call you back, they can ask you again and again. And that's really how charities raise a lot of money. So the downside of this for the charity is that they don't have a way to reach you again.
That is, until you need more groceries. In Austin, I'm Michael May for Marketplace Money.
I make a point of saying no thanks at the checkout counter when offered the opportunity to donate there. I've chosen my causes, and I stick to them. No matter how guilty it makes me feel to say no to that extra dollar for Race for the Cure. And I also put a premium on knowing where that money is going and how it's getting there. But Ashley Milne Type discovered there's often fine print involved in the promises charities make about what's happening with your donation.
Listen to a snippet of this ad from charity Plan USA.
When we met him, 12-year-old Alex had just watched both of his parents die. The only family he has now is a very old grandmother.
Several years ago, my heart melted at a similar ad from another charity, Christian Children's Fund. I began sponsoring a little boy in India. I sent about $25 each month. It helped fund a program to support and educate local families, including his. I wrote him letters. He wrote me back. Then the charity abruptly informed me they'd expelled the child and his family from the program. They said his parents weren't sticking to the rules and were misusing funds.
We do everything possible to keep that relationship going to benefit the child. But there must have been something that they felt the benefit wasn't going to the child.
That's Anne Lynham-Goddard. She's president of Child Fund International, which recently changed its name from Christian Children's Fund. She couldn't speak to my case, but she says it's rare for the charity to end a relationship between sponsor and child, and if it does, it's for good reason.
You know, our good stewardship would say if the child is not benefiting appropriately, then we would need to inform the sponsor of that.
Okay, so my rational side gets it. But I felt betrayed and terrible for the kid. There seemed to be a disconnect between what the charity promoted, the joys of the sponsor-child relationship, and the reality of cutting the cord for business reasons. Tim Ogden edits Philanthropy Action, a website for donors. He says I got caught up in what he calls the donor illusion, the promise of a direct connection between a donor and an individual recipient.
And it's an illusion that's created by the marketing, and it's created because it's a powerful one for attracting donations. But the reality is, if you really care about doing the most good, then there shouldn't be that direct connection.
Because, he says, charities need the flexibility to respond to the situation on the ground. That could mean using a donor's money for flood relief instead of buying a family a goat, or simply not allowing money to be misused. He says many charities expand on their business model in the fine print.
The big problem with donor illusion is, of course, that plenty of people don't read the fine print. And when they find out the way things really work, they feel lied to or misled, and they react very negatively.
Something like that has happened recently at another organization, Kiva. The nonprofit helps donors fund entrepreneurs, mainly in developing countries, through local microfinance organizations. Until recently, plenty of Kiva donors, including me, thought they were sponsoring a specific person. The site posts entrepreneurs' photos and stories and encourages you to pick one. But it turns out that donations actually backfill loans that have already been made. Matt Flannery is co-founder and CEO of Kiva. He says Kiva changed the wording on its website soon after the controversy blew up.
We learned through this process that our users wanted to see more detail upfront about the underlying mechanics. Now, those processes were always described on the site, but I think we learned that they needed to be described more prominently.
He says donations are still flooding in. But why tout the personal connection at all? Because it pulls people in. child sponsorship makes up the largest chunk of international giving in the U.S. Tim Ogden of Philanthropy Action believes it would be better if nonprofits drop the whole person-to-person idea.
The people who are being helped, the help they're getting is dependent on the whim of the donor, not on what they really need.
He says the more clear-eyed donors are, the better it is for the people who need their help. But that doesn't mean donors like me won't miss the illusion. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
So last week, as 2009 ended, we looked back at some of the lessons we all could have, should have learned from what turned out to be a mighty important year in personal finance, from credit cards to cash for clunkers. Recovery from the financial crisis has been slow, painful, and full of your questions. So we wondered how our advice fared for listeners who called in. And joining me for a review and update is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Happy New Year, Chris.
Happy New Year, Des.
We started to see a few trends emerging, at least in the questions that came our way. I have to say, I think more than any other subject, folks were baffled by what was going on with credit cards.
It was a flood of questions. It was all about the FICO score.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening to my credit score, which is all really tied to credit cards because the credit card companies were saying, you know, we're closing your account or we're going to cancel your line of credit or we're going to lower your line of credit. And we just seem to get one question after another about that.
I think there are a couple of ultimate lessons here, which is A, credit card companies are not your friend. And B,
hello.
Yeah, you as the consumer are not really entitled to anything, including any certain interest rate or your credit line. It can all be taken away at any moment.
The fact of the matter is you need to be your own financial safety net.
You know what else we did get a lot of questions about is the first-time home buyer credit. And Chris, what struck me here, tell me if you agree, is that lots of people somehow missed the lesson of the housing market collapse. And they still think that they should stretch to get into a home because, oh no, if they don't, they'll miss out on this credit.
All right, but here's the part that really got to me. The calls and the emails were coming from areas like Brooklyn, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. These are high-priced markets.
Yeah.
So $8,000 for a house that's what? $300,000, $350,000, $400,000. It just isn't that much money.
Yeah. So you can't take a look at that credit and say, well, because of that, I can afford a home. If that's the case, you shouldn't be buying, right?
You absolutely shouldn't be buying.
Well, student loans were also a huge issue that emerged last year. People struggling to pay them back decades after finishing school. So we fielded a lot of calls from folks who were struggling to pay off those debts. One of them was Catherine from Bellingham, Washington. She is a high school teacher who told us back in August that she had about $100,000 in student loan debt. So let's hear what she told us about what she is now telling her high school students about that debt.
I talk to my students about this every year, what really, really is financial aid and student loans, because I know that they don't get the education. I didn't get it, and I'm really paying for it right now.
I don't know if you remember this. In fact, Catherine was even putting off marriage because she didn't want her fiancé's income to be considered in the repayment of her debt. So we have Catherine back on the line. Hi, Catherine.
How are you? Thank you for calling.
Are all your student loans paid off now?
Well, actually, this year, it was my goal to get to under $80,000, and this past month I put on an extra $400, and I'm now at $79,999.
Oh, good for
That's
you.
That's wonderful. Congratulations.
We opened a bottle of champagne for it, so.
So now we must pop the question to you.
Yes.
Have you been able to move forward on the engagement?
No, we've decided not to do that for right now because there is no way for his income not to be counted. And also he becomes responsible for my student loan. I found out in case I were to become ill or if I died or something horrible like that, he would be responsible for it. And truthfully, I don't feel that he's responsible for that.
Chris, this is just wrong that someone is going to avoid having one of the happiest moments in their life because of a student loan.
Yes. And I would just have to say, Catherine, I understand that it's not his obligation, but I would move forward in your lives and pay off that student loan as fast as possible together. But you've made a decision not to, and I'm glad that repayment plan is working for you.
Yes, thank you. thank you. You know, there is a $5,000 teacher forgiveness situation that I'll be eligible for in 2 years. And then there's a payment plan that they're going to finish paying it off for me in 7 years. So I've been with him for 10 years. I figured another 7 finally when it's all paid off.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, but you were able to get rid of about 20% of it this year. So if you keep doing that year after year, that'll be less than 7 years anyway.
That's what I'm hoping for, is actually I'm going to probably beat the government to paying it off. I think basically, if all things go as planned, I'd like to have this paid off within the next 5 years. And if I can cut down the amount of interest that I'm paying, instead of paying $200,000, I will have paid about $130,000.
Do you ever look back and wonder about originally taking on $100,000 worth of student debt?
Every single day. I'm not joking when I say that. I'm on the federal student aid website as we talk right now, and I'm looking at all this money. And I knew that my parents were not knowledgeable about student loans, and my high school did not ever mention college to me, which is interesting, and that I got 2 masters at a school at which I was out-of-state tuition. Yes, if I could go back, I would have applied for scholarships. I would not have taken unsubsidized loans. That is the key word right there.
Yeah.
Because I did not know that that interest was accruing. That's just because of my boyfriend. He has an MBA, and he sat down when we first got together and looked at my student loans, and he said, "Do you know what this is?"
Yeah.
I'm sick about this most every month.
Well, I'm glad as a high school teacher that you're getting that message out, and hopefully we are here too. And in the meantime, keep paying that down and let us know when you finally set a date.
I will. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for calling, and good luck in 2010.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You can give us a call anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write us an email. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more reflections on 2009 later in the show. We'll hear from some folks who were contemplating traveling around the world and quitting their jobs in the middle of a recession. And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One of my New Year's resolutions really should be not to spend so much money eating out. Don't get me wrong, I love cooking too, but when you hit the sweet spot of fine dining, there is nothing like it. One of the best meals I had all year last year was a dish of the freshest sea scallops you could imagine. Lightly seared, sprinkled with pistachios, and immersed in, of all things, a watermelon broth. It totally worked. And it came to me via a restaurant called Lola in, of all places, Cleveland. As Dan Bobkoff reports from station WCPN, high-end restaurants are one bright spot in an otherwise dull local economy.
I didn't expect much from Cleveland's restaurants when I moved here 3 years ago. I had an East Coast snob's opinion of Midwestern cooking. Boy, was I wrong.
What are you thinking of ordering?
I could order anything on this menu and be happy.
I'm at lunch with food writer and Cleveland food booster Michael Ruhlman. We're sitting in a new restaurant called L'Albatro. It's an old carriage house with bold artwork on the brick walls. Our waiter comes over to help us decipher the appetizer.
It's a braised tongue and oxtail terrine with pickled mustard seeds. Next to it is kind of a roulade of sorts, pork with dried figs.
I think there was some rabbit in there, too. Foodies, take note. Here in the Rust Belt, you can now get a world-class meal for about what you'd pay at an Olive Garden.
Can you believe that? Duck confit, pork belly, 2 different kinds of sausages, and some great white beans for $14. You cannot beat that.
This restaurant opened up just last year at the height of the financial crisis. Yet owner and chef Zach Brule says L'Albatro is thriving. Cleveland's low cost of living means those with jobs can generally afford some nice meals. And he says there's a demand now for interesting food.
The sophistication level has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. I mean, if I would never have thought of doing this concept 25 years ago.
In the next few weeks, Brule will open his 4th new restaurant in 5 years. And he has competition like never before, from chefs like Dante Bucuzzi, who's putting the finishing touches on two new restaurants in Cleveland's up-and-coming Tremont neighborhood. It's gentrification, just blocks from once bustling steel mills.
Soft benches, nice coffee tables.
Bocuse made his name in big cities like New York, where the pace is fast and failure is common. Cleveland's cheap rent and lower startup costs make opening here a less risky bet.
Everything about it is a lot less. And I think that was one of the main draws that brought me back to Cleveland. Just the whole market itself. I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants, but it's not like there's 3,000 of them like New York City.
But 20 years ago, chefs like Bocuse likely wouldn't have had much luck in smaller cities. What changed? Americans got a lot more food savvy. They started to ask what's in their meals and where the ingredients came from. Organic and local food entered the lexicon. Enrollment went way up at U.S. culinary schools. And let's not forget the rise of the Food Network.
The next Iron Chef is Chef Simon!
Michael Simon, Cleveland's hottest chef, put his city on the culinary map when he won the Food Network's Iron Chef competition 2 years ago.
He has become the poster child for Cleveland, and every city needs a poster child.
Andrew Knowlton is the restaurant editor for Bon Appetit magazine. He and Cleveland food writer Michael Ruhlman were both judges on that show. Knowlton says the burgeoning foodie scene in Cleveland is a microcosm for what's happening nationwide, and that the availability of great ingredients from local farms gives the Midwest an edge.
You know, the food revolution is going to happen in the flyover states. It's not about New York and San Francisco.
Then, maybe I'm not a snob. Good food is now mainstream. So, in Cleveland, where the food's great, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, more updates from your calls. Turns out you don't always take our advice.
For our own happiness, we decided to just jump off a cliff and go for it. And we gave it a good 8 months and just decided it wasn't worth it.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Every year around this time, we do two things in our family. Go through the house and throw away or donate everything we haven't used or touched in the last 2-3 years. And rifle through files for old paperwork that can serve as kindling in the fireplace. Good for the soul and for the finances. Of course, it'd be easier if I could just donate it all to the Tess Vigeland Museum. That's how corporate America deals with its ephemera. Cash Peters reports.
Did you know Toyota has a museum? Quite honestly, it's a miracle they do. PR woman Cindy Knight.
We only started this maybe 10 years ago when we were celebrating our 40th anniversary in the United States. That's when we started to look around in our closets and our garages and say, hey, what do we have that displays and tells our story?
And what they had was almost nothing.
We had some vehicles housed in a dingy, nondescript warehouse, and that was just about it.
It's crazy. As you can imagine, there followed a lot of frantic hunting around, going to garage sales, emptying their closets, whatever they did, until eventually, ta-da!
So you have a museum then, I hear?
Yes, and welcome to the museum.
Yeah, thank you. They built a museum, a warehouse in Torrance, California, filled with $11 million worth of beautifully preserved Celicas, Corollas, and the disaster on four wheels, the Toyo Pet. Oh, yes. Curator Susan Zambon.
We actually started with the Toyo Pet, bringing it to America in 1957.
The Toyo Pet?
Yes, the Toyo Pet Crown.
Which I wouldn't buy on the grounds it sounds so awful. Who thought of that name?
It just was a shortened version of Toyota's Pet.
We celebrate our failures as well. Our first car in America was a complete flop that caused our company to go back to Japan, study what we did wrong.
Detach the horses and put an engine in it.
Yes. And then come back with something that we could actually sell to the American consumer.
Oh, you know who else has a great museum? Levi Strauss in San Francisco. Now, they were much better organized.
The Levi Strauss & Company Archives is a treasure house of garments.
That's the historian Lynn Downey on a video. And true, it's really fascinating. The company began when a guy called Jacob Davis came up with the idea of putting metal rivets in the pockets of work pants. And Levi Strauss, well, I guess he quit writing waltzes for a while to market the things. Of course, if I paid more attention to their museum in San Francisco, I'd know this stuff.
The company acquires historic garments from a number of different sources.
This is a pair of jeans that got too damaged to wear, so a guy left them behind in the mine so somebody else could hack off some of the denim to patch another pair. when mines would become abandoned or collapsed, these changing rooms would just be these little time capsules that these wacky guys in hazmat suits would go in, break in, and pull out the clothes and sell them to me.
These garments that we have here all tell a story. They belong to somebody in a particular...
We have always known what we were doing, which is not to say we didn't make a few missteps. We made polished cotton pants for men in 1958 in the exact colors of orange, lemon, and lime jello. Okay, they weren't really popular. But we knew what we
were
doing.
Where are those on the display?
Oh, they're in the archives, tucked away where nobody can, you know, buy
them. They're in a plastic bag under your bed at home.
Thank you. So...
I love that laugh.
Mr. Sandman, make me a dream.
Like Toyota, the Levi's collection also has holes in it. A, literally, it's a bunch of torn jeans, but B, because they had a disaster.
We lost everything in 1906 in the big earthquake and fire.
Oh, you did?
All of our corporate records, all of the patterns, all of the correspondence, everything about the deal between Levi and Jacob went up in flames in 1906.
And they still managed to scrape a decent museum together. But it's great that corporations are keeping track of their history. Also, they're all still looking for stuff. So if you happen to have an ancient pair of Levi's tucked away in the trunk of your Toyo pet, get in touch. There's no hurry. Lynn will always be there.
My goal is to work in the archives till I'm 103, drop dead in the collections, and haunt it for all eternity.
Well, you see, basically, I would like to see you hung up from clips
in
the archive.
Fine.
I'd like to see you just strung up by your shoulders. I'd pay to see that, actually.
There you go. In San Francisco, California, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
As we mentioned earlier in the show, we're checking back in with some listeners we talked to over the last year to see if and how they took our sage advice. And our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is with me. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, I like that. Sage advice. I'll take that.
Most sage. I'm sure you remember Nick from Los Angeles. Back in October, he wanted our advice on a pretty drastic decision he and his wife were making. Here's some tape of what they wanted to do.
My wife and I have been saving for multiple years to take a six-month world trip. And where we would love to take this trip, you know, with a poor economy, is this just a foolish, conspicuous consumption?
And Chris, your advice was something along the lines of go for it.
Go for it. And who can forget this question? I mean, we're in the midst of one of the worst economies in generations. And you want to go take a trip around the world. I think it was wonderful. You know, we only go around once.
Right. Well, Nick is on the phone again. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
So do you have tickets and reservations in hand?
We're not quite at that stage, but... We're planning on it. I mean, we're looking for probably around November of this year for weather purposes.
Okay. So where are you going first, and when can we meet you there?
Probably our first step will be Hawaii, followed by maybe Cambodia or Bangkok.
Being in Minnesota, the thought of being in Hawaii, since we're having freezing weather here, oh. I'm sorry, Tess, I interrupted you.
Chris in a reverie.
I know. I have to get a grip.
No, that's quite all right. We can all dream right along with Nick here. So Nick, talk us through, you know, after chatting with us on the show, how did you decide to go ahead and do it?
Well, you know, we've been saving for multiple years, so obviously it's not something we just decided right away.
Yeah.
I think also just the process of formulating the question was very helpful. You know, I had friends and family, some of them have heard me on the radio and wrote back, like, you have to do it.
Nice.
I'm curious, Nick, have you thought about how you're going to manage your money while you're traveling around the world?
We've been doing online banking for well over 10 years now. So we've traveled around the South America a little bit, and we've always used our debit cards, and we've never had any problems.
Oh, that's great.
And we actually even found a bank that will reimburse us any ATM fees anywhere in the world.
Nice.
It's a good deal.
Oh, that's fantastic. And just to be clear, you will get your job back, right?
Yes, I'll be able to take a leave of absence, and that's one of the reasons why it's a six-month limit.
Yeah.
My wife will, unfortunately, have to leave her work, but we can still make the finances work when we come back.
Well, I'm proud of you and envious, and do send us some postcards along the way, would you?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for your advice.
You're most welcome. Have a great trip.
That's great.
Thank you.
And next we have Vanessa on the phone. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
Now, back in March, you and your boyfriend were trying to decide whether to move from Boston to Los Angeles, right?
Yes.
And here again, we had some talk of leaving a job in the middle of a recession. He would leave his. You just graduated from grad school. But I do remember there was a twist to all this. Here's what Vanessa told us about that.
Well, we're going to stay with his parents, so we'll have free rent for up to a year. After that, I think it would be a little hard.
All right, so Vanessa, here's the loaded question. Where are you right now?
We are still in Boston, but we're planning on moving to L.A. at the end of January, and we're going to enjoy a road trip across the country and visit some national parks and go camping and see some friends and family along the way, and then move in with his family at the end of February and hopefully have a job lined up by summer.
Okay, well, with that in the background, Chris, if you don't remember what you said about moving without having work lined up beforehand, here's a tape to remind you.
It's not irresponsible to think about moving. What I wouldn't do is just quit, walk out the door, and make your move and then look for a job.
But it sounds like you are going to quit, walk out the door, and move without a job.
Yeah, we've tried his way for a little while, and it just, we just weren't very happy with the situation, and we wanted to be around family.
You're ready to make a move.
Yeah, we're ready. He's been ready for 2 years, and well, he's been on the East Coast for 10 years now, and I never wanted to be here longer than I had to be. And so for our own happiness, we decided to just jump off a cliff and go for it. And we gave it a good 8 months and just decided it wasn't worth it.
So the things that I would then start giving advice about is, all right, it's wonderful you're not paying rent, you'll be moving in with parents. You know, how do you, you know, help out at that household? If you're not paying rent, maybe it's doing some babysitting, maybe it's doing the laundry, it's doing the house cleaning, it's running errands, you know, all that kind of thing.
We're definitely going to sit down and have a talk about how we contribute financially and what our responsibilities are going to be. And, you know, we're kind of considering ourselves lucky that we have family that's willing to help us out and take us in for a little while. And so it could be worse.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. I was afraid I was going to get in trouble, so I'm glad you guys
No.
I do not consider what they're doing irresponsible. I think that, Vanessa, you have an approach for how you're going to be dealing with family. You're using this time to get your portfolios together and start pounding the pavement. Now, I'm really impressed with what you're doing. And I also, quite frankly, there may be a theme here, but I'm somewhat jealous that you're taking a road trip. So have a lot of fun on it.
So at this point, Chris, for the second call in a row, you would say go for it.
Go for it. I think that's going to be my motto for 2010.
Yeah, everyone should go for it.
Thanks so much for the call, Vanessa.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Chris, it has been fun walking down memory lane 09 with you.
Our callers are just wonderful.
Yeah, they're terrific, aren't they? Thanks so much for the advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And next week, we'll be tackling your questions about housing. So if you're wondering what to do with your mortgage, maybe whether to buy or sell property, do let us know. You can also write in with your question using the Getting Personal link. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We talked earlier in the show about the 50% club, folks who give away half their earnings because it's a good thing to do. Given the current economy, you might think that only those with the big bucks can afford philanthropy. Commentator Matthew Bishop urges us to think again.
Billionaire philanthropists like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are giving away their fortunes to wage war on America's failing schools and killer diseases like malaria. But what can the rest of us do? Those of us who have only a fistful of dollars to give. Bill Gates can make a difference, but can we? Really? The good news this giving season is, more than ever before, that yes, we can. The total amount of money given by ordinary people dwarfs the donations of the super rich. Now, thanks to some recent online innovations, our giving can have a much bigger impact than it used to. If you wrote a check or signed a petition, it used to be a hit or miss affair. Who knew where the money went, or if the signature was ever read? Now, if you care about Africa, you can help an entrepreneur through Kiva.org. Or if you want to help Asians fight climate change, click on globalgiving.com. Or if you want to help American teachers do better in the classroom, you can go to Donors Choose. What these websites offer is new and exciting ways for donors to see exactly how their money makes the world a better place. Take Donors Choose, for example. You decide what you want to buy. New history textbooks, maybe, or computers, or perhaps sports equipment. Whatever matters most to you. You can also decide whether to give locally or to a school in a poor neighbourhood on the other side of the country. Through donations as small as $25, Donors Choose has already helped 100,000 projects and touched millions of young lives. And you get a report back from the classroom so you know exactly how your money has made a difference. Experienced givers love the way they can now take control of their giving. Even better, these new websites have inspired thousands of first-time givers too. More money, making a bigger difference. What's not to love? So, this giving season, it is not just Bill Gates who knows he's making the world a better place. We all can.
Matthew Bishop is the New York bureau chief for The Economist magazine. His book is called Philanthrocapitalism: How Giving Can Save the World. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. All right, fess up. Did you keep your New Year's resolutions last year? I kept one out of three. Two of those were financial, as we discussed on last week's show. And lots of you made money resolutions this year as we all tossed in the seas of the economic crisis. So back in January, we aired some of the promises you made to yourself. And now we're checking back in with three listeners to find out how the year shaped up for them.
I'm Julie Larson, and I'm calling from Tucson, Arizona. Last year, I was faced with the prospect of being laid off. I work in the travel industry. I knew it was coming. I had time to prepare. I just wanted to trim my expenses, not spending on clothes, music, and going out to eat less. I was laid off in April, and I was out of work for 6 months. I did not burn through all of my savings. In 2010, I hope to have a more stable career. The travel industry has been hard hit. Transitioning into teaching seems like that would be a much better career plan for me.
Jack Duderman, and I'm from Jamestown, North Carolina. As I recall, I said that I was going to kind of lay low, make very few trades, not do anything radical until I could tell exactly what was going on with the stock market and the economy. I paid off my mortgage. I put in a new heating system, and that was a wonderful investment of that money. I did a little bit of trading to try and get in on the bottom. After I bought AIG at $3, it went down. But I am very itchy to get back in. I wasn't watching that closely last year. I will be doing it more closely this year.
My name is Chris Patron, and I'm calling from Houston, Texas. From the start of this year, they were save as much money as possible, try to use credit unions more instead of banks, and pay everything I can in cash. But when I look back at my bank account, I see that I saved almost $50,000. I also see that I've placed it into a credit union that's earning pretty decent interest. I'm still sticking with that adage that I came up with. When banks collude, the customer gets screwed. And I've been pretty ruthless on containing costs. We still do things. So I was able to go to Disneyland, but every single cost was already accounted for. So we paid for it all with cash. In 2010, I'm going to keep keeping on saving cash, keeping my head low, and waiting for the economy to get better.
All right, let's do this again. Go to our website, marketplace.org. Tell us what your financial resolution or resolutions are for 2010. We'll air the best of them next week and hold them to account a year from now. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, as job seekers try everything from tweeting to Facebooking and beyond to make themselves stand out from the crowd, one technology merits a skeptical eye.
It looks like one of these kidnapping videos from the Middle East. Not probably ideal for interviewing a candidate.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. To all you Longhorns and Crimson Tide, welcome to Pasadena, and please feel free to leave a good chunk of your disposable income in my town. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.